This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up later in the show, we're going to talk all about state bonding, so stay with us. But first, recently we talked about Asian Americans on the show. They're the fastest growing population nationwide, including here in Connecticut. The state's Asian American population grew more than 60% from 2000 to 2010. A recent report looks at ways advocates for survivors of family violence can improve its outreach to Asian women in the state. To tell us more, we invited Wendy Mota Kasongo to the studio. She's Director of Diversity and Accessibility at the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Wendy, welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning, Lucy. Thank you for having me.
Explain why the coalition decided to do this specific report.
So, you know, Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence is a nonprofit organization, and like many other nonprofit organizations, we're federally and, you know, state-funded. And it was a conversation that we've had for a really long time, and I think we were just at a very interesting point where we can start doing something about it. So we did. And, you know, understanding, like you said, that the population, the Asian population, is quickly growing, we want to be able to address that in a way that makes sense to victims of Asian descent.
So when we talk about Asian Americans, when we talk about Asian Americans in Connecticut, what parts of the state are they living, and where? What countries are we talking about?
So in terms of countries, the U.S. Census tells us, for example, Cambodia, China, India, Japan, Korea, Malaysia, Pakistan, the Philippine Islands, Thailand, and Vietnam. And so thinking in terms of who's in Connecticut, which was part of the process for this, we see pockets all throughout the states, but primarily in Fairfield County, New Haven County, and Hartford County.
When we talk about family violence or domestic violence, I guess we should maybe establish a framework of where people can go in the state for help if they need it. And then from there, how did you figure out what's a better way to reach these Asian families?
So it's still a process. You know, we're still I think this report really gave us an opportunity to start the conversation, but it's still a process in terms of services. Here's what we know, Lucy. We have 18 domestic violence programs in the state of Connecticut. The coalition is kind of like the mom or the umbrella agency to these 18 domestic violence program. We're here to support it. And we do things, a lot of things in terms of services for victims in a very good way, right? So we have shelters, counseling, court advocates. But when working with underserved populations, we understand that there's a lot of victims that will not come through our doors. So while we can definitely say these are some local domestic violence program, part of this was also understanding how to serve people in a way that matters to them. And it sounds simplistic, but it's really the engine behind this whole project and this whole report.
At these shelters, at these community programs, were you seeing an uptick in clients of Asian descent, and were there challenges in how to help them?
Sure. So we see some of them, and primarily through the courts, you know, and not only Asian, the most amount of victims that we serve come through the courts. And so, you know, criminal courts, mm-hmm. to be exact. And so some of these victims actually never make it back to the local program. So, yes, there are Asian victims that come through the court systems if there's been an arrest or if something has a cord related to family violence. But again, this is really about understanding what we do, what's happening in terms of the community, the Asian community, and then how can we better serve them.
I read the report, and we're going to link to the report on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. But that was interesting. And when we talk about Asian cultures, obviously many different countries, many different customs and beliefs, but we look at the comparison between collectivist cultures versus individualist cultures. Can you explain that to our listeners and how that is a challenge when you're trying to reach people that are dealing with domestic violence?
Sure. That's a great question, Lucy. I think, you know, in my years in working in the domestic violence field, this is what I understand. The domestic violence movement was born in the United States in the 1960s and 70s with hand-in-hand with the feminist movement. And it was a group of white middle-aged women who were feminists and didn't want to be mistreated or abused by their partners, right? And so I think it's a great movement, but an unintended consequence was really that some communities were marginalized. And so because the movement was born out of that, a lot of our services and intervention mimic independent and individual kind of approaches to domestic violence. When we're working with the Asian communities, like other communities, we realize that it's a collective culture, meaning, you know, the family is upheld. It's not really deemed, it's not necessarily important for a woman to leave her husband and become independent and kind of go out on her own. And so and that was very different for us, right? When we look at the services that we provide, you know, it's kind of like the number one solution is leave the man, talk about it, reach out. And that's not necessarily the approach that would be the best approach with Asian victims. Mm-hmm. Collectivism really speaks to getting the input from community members, family members, and really solving issues in a more familial and traditional way. Sometimes that may include the batterer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that sounds, I guess, really problematic in the sense of, in this country, if someone is being abused, like you said, the first step is leave the abuser. But in certain cultures, the family unit is very important. They're worried about shame and stigma if they leave their spouse. So how do you reach these potential victims?
So we're still learning. We're still learning. But I think part of the solution is really looking at informal support to domestic violence. And I don't know if this is the right terminology, but almost coming in through the back door, really looking to create opportunities where, yes, we can talk about domestic violence, but that may not be the first thing on the list. And so looking at ways where we can support communities and families even, and really almost creating the space where people will talk, and if there is family violence, we'll have an opportunity to connect them to resources, but really not necessarily going in domestic violence heavy. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm in studio with Wendy Mota Kasongo. She's with the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. The coalition just recently released a report about how the state could better serve Asian Americans living in the state, many who come from countries where obviously the culture is different. And if there is abuse in the home, not necessarily mean that they're able to leave their home. And so Wendy's here to talk about ways to reach that community. You know, I was looking at the report. Again, it'll be on our website, Wendy. But there was a case study of a woman, a Chinese immigrant. I'm not sure I'll pronounce her name right. Is it Chun Tao?
Yes, that sounds good to me.
Just to kind of explain to our listeners some of the dynamics of going on with this particular individual that was featured of, you know, some of the issues of why she couldn't readily leave if she was being abused.
So Chantal really mimics kind of like the scenario for maybe an Asian victim. She is 25 years old and she came from China 2 years ago to join her husband who immigrated 5 years ago. And a neighbor called the police after listening to some of the loud sounds, yells that were coming from the apartment. And so when the police arrived, neither the police, the police officers, I'm sorry, didn't speak Mandarin. And after an hour of trying to communicate and gather information, they left because there was not enough evidence for an arrest. And so Chen Tao is a victim of abuse that wants the abuse to end, but she doesn't want the authorities involved. And I think that speaks to the fact that while 911 is an option for many victims to stay safe, it might not necessarily be an option for all victims. And so, The police do not play a rehabilitative role in her hometown, and that could be for many reasons. Immigrants come to this country, and they either trust or don't trust authorities. And so especially when English is not your first language, it could be a very confusing, scary, lonely place to be. And so I think it gives us – this case gives us an opportunity to really look at some of the dynamics of family violence for someone that is coming to this country, doesn't understand the system. And listen, I mean, the system is confusing even for us born in this country. Can you imagine someone is going through something as traumatic as family violence, does not speak the language, and has no idea how to address it. So that's really what the case is about.
We talked a little bit about how domestic violence has been defined through the years in this country. Again, when we think about domestic violence, we think about oftentimes a woman being the victim, and it's her spouse, her male spouse, who is perpetrating the crime against her. But I was reading in this report that in certain cultures, domestic violence isn't necessarily the spouse or the husband, other people in the family. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So, you know, and again, even when we were in the process of gathering some of this information, it was just very interesting because, yes, you're right, domestic violence is traditionally understood as the women being the victim. So just as domestic violence professionals, we understand that it can happen in same-sex relationship. It can happen when the man is the victim. But within the context of this report, we very quickly understood that the dynamic can encompass family members as well. And I'll give you an example. Some of the victims that we saw and spoke about for the report were abused by the husband's mother. And so, and physically abused, verbally abused and psychologically abused. So because of the respect and kind of the hierarchical process and way of seeing things, the victim was abused and the abuse was promoted by other family members because it's not okay to talk about it. So, yeah, the mom-in-law, the mother-in-law was also part of the abuse. Yeah.
So how do you reach, again, victims within these communities where they may not have a lot of support? Their only support is their family. If there's abuse happening in the family, you know, where do you go from here?
So it's a combination of different strategies. I think, you know, on one end, we do want to partner and collaborate with the service providers and the entities that are already doing the work and that have the cultural knowledge for Asian communities in Connecticut. That's very, very important to us, starting these conversations with, you know, smaller organizations, but, you know, being able to see how can we support the work that they are doing. And then the other piece to this is really, you know, education, building capacity for our member programs, our domestic violence advocates, so that if there is a victim that comes through our doors, we're either able to link them to someone to help with the process or ourselves better understand it. And then the last piece we're looking at, it's really outreach statewide. How can we send this message that this is important to the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence and that, honestly, this is just the beginning.
So you're collaborating with community organizations and partners in the community. What about training for the authorities, the police departments?
I think that's one aspect of it. And, you know, we will get to that point. Absolutely. It's something that it's necessary not only for Asian communities, but for any underserved community. Training is a huge part of it. Training not only law enforcement and first responders, but, you know, just professionals working with these victims. And, you know, we do have a training institute at CCADV, and that's definitely part of the curriculums that we put out there. But in particular, I mean, in specific to this report, it's baby steps. So, yeah.
I want to thank Wendy Mota Kasongo from the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. We'll link to the report on our website, WMPR.org/where we live. Wendy, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me, Lucy. It was great being here.
This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Last week on WMPR's weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, Hartford Current columnist Kevin Rennie said the use of bonding in the state has changed.
It's become another way of paying for things that used to be in the yearly general budget.
That got us wondering, how has the state's practice of borrowing changed over the years? Who better to ask than budget guru Keith Faniff, a reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. He joins us now in studio. Hi, Keith.
Hi. I never get used to that title.
We love calling you the budget guru. You're a good explainer of things that seem complicated to most of us, including bonding. Why should the average citizen, average taxpayer care about this?
I think in part because it is sometimes seen as so wonky. there's not often, and I guess I'm casting equal blame across both sides of the aisle, there's not always an honest debate about it. The understanding is just that most people aren't going to get it, so people look for the one or two points that they think the public will grasp, and that's what they're focusing on. But we're really talking about the state's credit card. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have really two big financial packages that happen every year. You have the budget. We pay for things. Think of that as paying for things in cash in your household. And then, again, there's the bond package, and you think of the credit card. And there are many legitimate purposes for bonding. People think of things like municipal school construction, capital projects at colleges and universities, roads and rail work, open space and farmland preservation, and yes, the small community-based projects in legislators' districts that sometimes get called pork barrel spending. But for most of those things, and we can debate the pork, there's a valid purpose for paying for something over 20 years, because if you're talking about, say, a road improvement or a bridge improvement, it's going to be used. And the question is, maybe it should be extended into a second generation. Also, if you paid for them all at once in cash, you would have a very volatile budget. You'd have to come up with a ton of money in the year that you're finishing the Q bridge, and then the next year the expenses would drop off the grid. And the big debate going on at the Capitol right now is, has the credit card become used more so sort of to cover day-to-day expenses? In other words, are we buying our groceries with our credit card? We're cutting. I'm trying to do sarcastic air quotes on the radio. That doesn't work. But we're quote-unquote cutting expenses out of the budget, but we're not really cutting the expenses. We're just paying for them with borrowing, which means we're actually increasing the cost because there's interest involved.
And how does our interest that Connecticut pays, how is that impacted in terms of how much we're borrowing? What are we seeing?
Well, what we're seeing, I mean, first of all, just to start, Connecticut is the most indebted state on a per capita basis in the nation. We have about $22 billion just in bonded debt. We're not talking about what we owe to the pension funds or what we owe for retiree health care for public sector workers. We're just talking about projects that we finance by selling bonds on Wall Street. What we've been seeing over the last 5 years is an average of about $120 million in what I'll call traditional budget expenses moved onto the credit card just by the use of something called bond premiums. You might hear that tossed around, and that is causing a problem at the Capitol. Premiums are kind of like food. If you use them well, you're very healthy. If you eat milkshakes all the time, you're going to end up with diabetes. We need sometimes to offer a premium on Wall Street to issue our bonds. They're an effective marketing tool. And what that is we might be looking to borrow money at a particular interest rate, and an investor says, I want a higher rate, but the state really is not ready. They don't have the money for that. So what the investor says is, I'll give you a hypothetical. Say we were going to borrow money at 2% and the investor wants it at 2.2. The investor says, I'll give you the extra money that you'll owe, the difference in interest that you'll have to pay. I'll give it to you. I'll hand it to you right now. And then you can hand it right back to me. And you won't be any worse off. It'll be like you're paying 2%, but I'll still have on paper a 2.2% bond. And that can be advantageous in the bond trading market. And don't worry, your listeners don't have to worry about that. The problem is we're not handing the money right back to him. Mm-hmm. We are taking that money and we're putting it in our checking account and we're using it to buy groceries. So it's like borrowing money, putting it in your savings or your checking account and treating it like income.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In studio with me is Keith Faniff, state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. We're talking about bonding, how the state is borrowing to pay for a lot of different things in the state. On the phone with us now is Representative Chris Davis. He's a ranking member of the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee. He represents the towns of Ellington and East Windsor in the General Assembly. And he's also a member of the Bond Commission. Hi, Representative Davis, here on Where We Live.
Hi, good morning.
So tell us what your role is as a member of the Bond Commission. Explain this to our listeners of how this all works.
So the Bond Commission is a 10-member panel. It's done by statute, I believe. Keith, correct me there. But it features the chairman, of both the Senate and House chairman of the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee and the two ranking members of the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee. The governor is the chair of the Bond Commission. He also has his OPM secretary, his Office of Policy and Management secretary, his commissioner of Department of Administrative Services, and then some of the constitutional officers also sit on the Bond Commission, so the state comptroller, the state treasurer, state attorney general. So right now, as it's structured, there's only two Republicans on the State Bond Commission, and the rest of them are Democrats.
Lately, we've been hearing from Republicans, specifically Senator Fasano, Len Fasano, about criticizing the Malloy administration and the Democrats for this over-reliance, so to speak, on borrowing to pay for things in the state, and, you know, including pork in specific districts. You know, you're often one of the lone dissenting voices on the commission. I mean, what's your take on the state's practice of borrowing?
Well, I mean, the State Bond Commission is rather unique in that we as a legislature, we authorize a certain kind of block grants, amount of money for each type of project that you could have in the state of Connecticut. But it's really up to the governor, and it's a kind of a unique situation where the governor has the sole authority to determine what items get put onto the state bond agenda and then ultimately what we end up voting on. And I think a lot of the criticism that we've seen in the last few months is where are the priorities for the state of Connecticut when it comes to bonding? As Keith had just mentioned, we're one of the most indebted states as far as bonding goes. We've seen bonding under the Malloy administration increase by almost $1 billion this year from when he first came in. We were averaging maybe $1.4 billion or so a year at its peak for bonding. And now we're looking at potentially bonding up to $2.5 billion this year if the governor meets the numbers that he was talking about. And that's over just the last 6 years. We've seen almost $1 billion increase in the amount of bonding that we do. So as Keith had mentioned, many of these projects are something that we should be doing long-term, paying for roads and bridges and things like that. But the criticism that has been coming up lately is where are the priorities for the general obligation bonds, the bonds that are paid for with the revenues that come into the general fund for things like whether they be band shells in Windham or private museums getting funding or statues in Hartford. Are those the priorities for the state of Connecticut, or is it truly things that we should be spending money on, like school construction, roads and bridges, clean water, those items that bonding is really supposed to be intended for?
I wanted to ask Keith, since we mentioned Governor Malloy's administration, when we look back at Governor Rell, you know, how did she treat the state's credit card?
Well, it's really apples and oranges, in part because of the economic circumstances during which Jody Rell and Daniel Malloy served as governor. With the exception of the last couple of years, Governor Rell served during a very strong economic times. She didn't need to rely as often on the credit card because, quite frankly, the money was there in the budget. I mentioned, and it won't get wonkier than bond premiums. I won't put your listeners through that again. But we've seen over the last few years things like municipal aid, certain grants we've moved back onto the credit card. We give the towns about $60 million a year for road maintenance. But believe it or not, the single biggest thing they spend that on is snow removal. Well, when you see your roads being plowed, we're paying interest on that. We're actually borrowing that money that the towns use to hire contractors to plow their roads. Stem cell research, we used to pay for that out of cash. That's now in the operating, on the credit card. Certain pollution abatement programs, that's, I think, where you're seeing the concern that's happening now. But by the same token, that didn't happen under Governor Rell in large part because that we were flush with cash. The temptation when times are tight is to take money out of the budget because people notice the budget and put it on the credit card because nobody pays attention to it, even though it ultimately is going to cost you more. That's probably the biggest difference. There's one other I'll point out, though. Chris mentioned how the Bond Commission is really the gatekeeper of borrowing. That's the panel that decides. The legislature can, think of a restaurant menu. They can put all these projects on the menu potentially to be financed with borrowing, but only the Bond Commission can say we're going to do A, B, C, not D, not E. However, We're starting to put food on our plate faster than we can eat it. When Governor Rell left office, we had about $3 billion in bonding that had been approved by the Bond Commission, but we still hadn't actually borrowed the money. It was approved on paper, but the treasurer hadn't gone to Wall Street and borrowed the money, and it's not the treasurer's fault. She's not going to borrow it until we're ready to spend it. But because we don't have enough money in the budget to make payments on our credit card, because we don't have enough DOT architects and engineers to ramp up projects, we had about a $3 billion bonding backlog. That backlog, $7.5 billion, about 5.5 years later. Mm-hmm. So we are still going forward planning all this borrowing, but we can't even execute it, which is also making some people, I mean, that gets really wonky, but some people are wondering, well, why are we approving it all if we can't even get it out the door anyway? Mm-hmm. Because Wall Street does still pay attention, and it doesn't, they still are concerned about the level of debt we're even planning. And that's a new development under this administration, much more so than the last one.
So how does that impact our credit rating?
Well, unfortunately, in the last couple of years, our outlook has not been good. All four of the major Wall Street credit rating agencies, Standard & Poor's, Fitch, Moody's, and Kroll, have all at different times had us on what they call a negative outlook, which is we're watching you closely over the next couple of years. And usually that's the precursor to a potential downgrade. Since, in addition to that, two of the four that I mentioned have actually now downgraded us, which means in the long run, it will cost us more money to borrow.
So our children will be dealing with this as they pay taxes.
Well, unfortunately, yeah, it's going to be an issue for some time. But I think probably the single biggest thing right now is what we're using the credit card for. That's probably the debate you're going to hear quite a bit between now and Election Day.
And so if we weren't, if the state weren't using our credit card to pay for these, you know, pork projects in specific communities, I mean, the state's still pretty worse off, right, in terms of there's not enough money to pay for the important things like capital improvements.
Well, I mean, this is the trade-off, though. If you, for example, the Republican minorities in the House and Senate had a proposal earlier this year, their own alternative budget, and they wanted to save about $70 million in payments on the credit card. That's the one way the credit card shows up in the budget. We borrow money, we have to pay on the principal and the interest. To save about $70 million in principal and interest, they were going to have to cancel probably about 10 times that amount. In borrowing. Now, what if that does come out of school construction? What if that does come out of projects at UConn and the CSU system and the community colleges? Those are projects that create jobs. There is a trade-off. You know, Governor Malloy has a point when he says, look, a lot of the money we borrow does actually stimulate the economy. Of course, he's not going to point to the areas where we're also borrowing just to cover our operating expenses. But Connecticut needs to use its credit card. It's just in these times you really want to try to use that borrowing in ways that are going to put people to work who will then in turn be paying more income taxes. They'll be making more purchases. There'll be more sales tax, more economic activity generated in general.
Representative Davis.
Just speak on what the Republican plan was. We actually not only put out our own budget, but earlier in the year we actually put out our own bonding agenda. That called for fully funding, or at least funding to historic levels, school construction projects to the tune of about $450 million a year. That would be at average or above average of what we were spending. We would have fully funded the CSU projects, the UConn projects. But what we did call for is cutting back on the discretion that the governor had for some of these projects in various districts around the state, kind of limiting that to about $100 million a year. And saying, you know, that's where we can find significant savings.
No, but the Republican plan, Chris, also would have capped actual bond issuances, literally
yes,
how much money
yes.
we could have borrowed to the tune of about $1 billion, $800 to $1 billion less. You mm-hmm. would not have found $800 to $1 billion in pork. That would have unavoidably come out of construction work.
And some of it would have been
a huge chunk
shifting from STO bonds, the special tax bonds for transportation projects, and using some of those GO bonds to be able to cover some of those projects as well. But Yeah, I think Keith has a point. I mean, it does. You know, you have to prioritize where some of those projects are going to be. You know, certainly we need to do something. We need to be able to rein in some of the spending. And total, we would have been in the Republican plan, still would have been about $1.75 billion, which historically would have been higher than what it was just a few years ago by over $300 million a year. So it certainly wasn't some kind of draconian cut in bonding and projects being, you know, halted as they're shoveled or in the ground. It would have been a situation where we would have had to shift those priorities and really look at what we were doing as a state of Connecticut as far as bonding goes.
We're talking about bonding on Where We Live, how the state is borrowing to pay for capital improvements all the way to pork projects. This is Where We Live, and in studio with us is Keith Faniff, state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, and on the phone, State Representative Chris Davis, who's a member of the Bond Commission and represents the towns of Ellington and East Windsor in the General Assembly. You know, there was just a recent Bond Commission meeting the other week. So of the things that are approved, can you talk about the process, Keith, of from now, once it's approved, where does it go? And again, when will Treasurer Napier actually get that money to be spent?
It is really confusing. If I can just quickly, I also wanted to mention, I should have. I tried to think of all the things I wanted to go through so everybody could learn everything about bonding. Paying on our debt service takes up a big chunk of our budget now. One out of every $9 in the budget actually goes to pay on the credit card. So that's, I mean, it's a significant amount of money that you can't spend on other things. In answer to your question, think of, I like to use this analogy a lot, think of bonding like a restaurant menu. Only the legislature can actually write the menu, and they're going to put more projects and more programs on there than we're actually ever going to implement. That's intentional. They are not, and I don't mean that that they're trying to be reckless. they're casting a wide net. So you might see a specific transportation project mentioned. As Chris pointed out, you might see a large pot of money for a program. The governor has given large pots of money in something like the Urban Act, and this is a large amount of potential borrowing that he can use for various economic development projects. Then only the Bond Commission can actually decide it's time to borrow money for this item, it's time to borrow money for that item. And as Chris pointed out, we are starting to do a lot more in terms of putting the Bond Commission moving projects forward. Just because the Bond Commission approves it, though, and this is the part I think it's probably least understood at the Capitol, that doesn't mean the money's actually going to be spent. When the Bond Commission approves financing, all they're doing really is sending a permission slip to the treasurer saying, if anyone ever confronts you with a bill, then you can go borrow the money so we can pay it. But many times, the Bond Commission approves a project, particularly in the area of transportation, and the administration decides, yeah, we still aren't really ready to do that work. We don't have enough people to get that project started. Or maybe we just don't have enough money in the budget to start making the payments on it if we borrow it. So the Bond Commission approval is just the last step, and it lags there. And again, you can't blame the treasurer. She's not going to borrow the money if we're not going to spend it. That's the last stage, and I hate to do this, but you'll hear there are a bunch of A verbs thrown around. The legislature, they call it authorizes bonding. Don't think dictionary definition. That's got a very legal definition. Mm-hmm. The Bond Commission allocates. And then lastly, the administration allots the money. So it really is a three-step process. And as I mentioned, there's like $7.5 billion in potential financing allocated by the Bond Commission that still only exists on paper that we haven't done. And the treasurer, by the way, doesn't go to Wall Street on a project-by-project basis. You want to wait until the interest rates are right. Certain times of the year we will borrow a big chunk of money, and then it will get it used. I will mention one last thing also. We keep our bonded dollars in a common cash pool with the same money that we use for the budget. So many times we're temporarily transferring money over from the capital side into the budget side just to pay bills. And then the budget sort of has an IOU. It's got to square up later with the bonding. And the problem is when the state gets into bad cash flow situations, some people think we're borrowing just so there's enough money in the cookie jar to pay the budget's bills. That's another problem. Why sometimes we borrow when people say, well, why are we even borrowing that money right now?
Representative Davis, if I could return to you, you know, we keep hearing about the looming budget deficits in the upcoming years. I mean, are you confident that the state's reliance on bonding is going to change in the next few years?
Well, I think it's certainly a fear for people on both sides of the aisle, quite frankly, of, you know, how are we going to fund some of these projects that we want to continue to fund or we would like to continue to fund when we're facing a potentially, you know, $2 to $3 billion deficit in the next few years. And Keith mentioned many different areas earlier that we've seen shifts from general fund allocations, expenditures that we used to pay for town aid road right out of the budget. We used to pay for stem cell research. And this last year, we shifted biomedical research fund money that used to be paid for by the tobacco settlement fund that we get each year. We shifted that to bonding so that we can then sweep that tobacco settlement fund money as a state of Connecticut to be able to pay for things other than what it was intended for. I think there is a real fear that if we continue down the path that we're having now, more and more appetite would be for shifting these programs to bonding. Unfortunately, as we have been talking about for the last few minutes, we really can't afford to continue to do that with the amount of bonding that we have on the books. Like Keith said, over $7 billion that has been allocated and hasn't been issued yet. You know, we really have to be careful about how we're going to move forward with shifting some of these programs to bonding, especially given the fact that, you know, interest rates aren't going to stay low forever. And if we dig ourselves into a hole where we're wholly relying on funding a lot of these programs through bonding, when interest rates continue to go up, it's only going to cost our kids and our grandkids even more if we want to continue with those programs.
I just wanted to add, because that's a really good question about where our bonding is going, heading potentially into, you know, if the economy starts to slip in the next couple of years. One big area that we do borrow periodically that I left out are what are called economic recovery notes, which is just jargon for deficits. When we literally run the budget in the red and we don't have any money left in the bank, we have to borrow. For example, in 2009, we had emptied our emergency reserve, which everybody calls the rainy day fund. The budget closed $1 billion in the red. So we borrowed the money. And we're still paying off our debt, our bonded debt from the last recession. We started to make headway on that, and we took a two-year break in the last 2 years of Governor Malloy's first term. We took what his budget director called a holiday from paying on our debt, which also had the advantage of keeping the budget down during the last 2 years of Governor Malloy's term. Well, now that money, we're paying on it again. Plus, since we refinanced it, we're paying an extra $40 million in interest for kicking that can down the road. But we have almost nothing left in the rainy day fund again. We only have about $150 million, which sounds, how can I say that's not much? But that doesn't even represent 1% of our annual operating costs. Kevin Lembo, the comptroller, says you should have a cushion of about 15%. So that means even if a year from now we finish with another deficit, we're probably going to have to borrow. And if we go into recession, you can see you're not talking about borrowing $100, $200 million. If we go into recession, you could see revenues drop up $1 to $1.5 billion in 1 year. And then you could be looking at another major use of the credit card just to allow Connecticut to square the books at the end of the fiscal year.
And what about more cuts in the state budget? You know, we've heard about layoffs and vital services, reduced services. I mean, is it just a warning that this will continue?
Well, you're going to see probably no matter what a combination of cuts and tax increases on a fairly regular basis, arguably for the next two decades, because we're entering a period where the other part of our debt, the money we owe the pension system and the money we owe for retiree health care, obligations that are coming due and big expenses that we haven't saved for, and they are driving up the cost. These are parts of the budget that are growing by double-digit percentages year after year in many cases. So if you're seeing growth of that kind, it's so much. It's kind of like, well, if you have a tree stump in your backyard and I send you out with a penknife to shave a few pieces off, that's great. You didn't make the problem any worse, but that's just not enough. I think Connecticut will be hard-pressed to start avoiding things, particularly once we get into the 2020s.
Representative Davis, what are you hearing from your constituents? Obviously, this conversation does not instill a lot of confidence in our listeners in terms of how the state is managing its finances.
No, I mean, I think that's a very good point. I think people's confidence level in state government is very low, especially over these last few years. I mean, I just had a meeting at my local senior center the other day, and the main topic was the budget and how we're going to handle it and what it means for the future of the state of Connecticut. You know, when we say, you know, we had a largest tax increase in 2011, we had to come back and do it again just last year or 2 years ago. And now, you know, and Keith is mentioning we're going to either have to do it again in the next couple of years or make drastic cuts that we haven't seen before. I think it sends a...
No, I said you're going to do both.
Yeah, I mean, you may have to in order to make things meet here. You know, one of the arguments is that, you know, we could have been cutting back over the last few years rather than having everything come to roost this year with the amount of layoffs that we've had to do or that we're supposed to do and we haven't done yet. In this fiscal year. I think the fear is that, you know, the rainy day fund is pretty much emptied. People recognize that now. They know that we're going to be facing deficits because revenues are not meeting projections that we thought we were going to have over the last few years as a state. And it's a situation where our economy is just stagnated and not growing anywhere near at the pace that the rest of the country is. And I think people fear that, you know, unless our economy turns around, those revenues are going to continue to decline. And the policies that we're making in Hartford could potentially be driving some of those wealthy individuals out of our state. And it's not even just policies coming out of Hartford. Some of the federal policies for taxes may be driving people out of our state when it comes to, you know, onshoring money back into America in this next year. You know, the real fear is that some of these hedge funds, managers and some of these other individuals with high income will be making the decision that, yes, we'll have to pay those federal taxes when we onshore this money, but we can choose to move somewhere mm-hmm. else and not pay state taxes. And I think we're already starting to see that. New Jersey's had a huge impact because of that. And I think we've seen a few of our major millionaires move out of our state in the last couple of years in part because of that. And that's only going to continue to drive revenues down and cause us even more budget problems in the years to come.
I'll let Keith Faneth have the last word before we break.
Oh, I should have just pointed out, Lucy, the problem with our pensions is not something that happened overnight. This big cost pressure on the budget actually goes back all the way to 1939. For about seven decades, we didn't save enough money. Between 1939 and 2010, past governors and legislatures hired state employees and let the future find the money for their benefits. So it's not something that developed overnight.
Well, I want to thank Keith Faneth, state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, also State Representative Chris Davis from the towns of Ellington and East Windsor for joining us to talk all about bonding. When we return, we're going to hear from a student in Connecticut who's in Cleveland to protest outside the Republican National Convention. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Illegal immigration was front and center opening night at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Trump's campaign slogan, Make America Great Again, was transformed into Make America Safe Again and featured speeches about the importance of border control, and delegates heard from Americans who've lost loved ones in crimes committed by undocumented immigrants. Some members of Connecticut's Students for a Dream traveled to Cleveland to protest Donald Trump's rhetoric on immigrants. One of them joins us by phone now. Yenimar Cortez is in Cleveland again with the group Connecticut Students for a Dream. Yenimar, you're on Where We Live.
Hi, hello. My name is Yenimar. I came and traveled to Cleveland, Ohio to speak up about the hatred that has been coming at us. I came here with United We Dream Action, and I'm very excited to tell you guys about the action and why we're strong and why we should not give up and why we should stand up to hate, the hatred that has been coming from the Trump's presidency.
Well, Yenimar, tell me a little bit about your family background. How did you come to Connecticut?
Yeah, okay. I'm originally from Mexico. I came here when I was 2 years old. I was brought here, you know, for the same reasons that everyone's brought here, for a better future, so I can get an education, so I can better myself and, you know, become someone that can help others more than I'm doing right now with my education. So I've been living in Connecticut all my life. It's been my home. America has been my home. So just hearing all the stuff that Trump's been saying about separating us, building a border, it's just heartbreaking because it's like separating two worlds that I live in and that I love. I love Mexico and I love America because it's my home. So it's just, it's very heartbreaking, and it's honestly so hate. It's so much hate going on.
Yanomar, if you could explain to listeners and to people who really believe that border control is something that the country should be for, they should be able to control who comes into our country and that there's a legal system in place to do that. Can you explain to our listeners, you know, what your ideas are on terms of helping people who want to come to this country, but to do it in a legal way?
Okay. Yeah. I think when people think about illegals, as they say, coming in the country, they don't really see the reason why they come. They just see it as, it's illegal. But if we look back and we actually look at the problem of why they're coming, we can see that they come because of poverty. We can see that they come because, opportunities that they don't have in the countries. And as we say, America is so great and has opportunities. So I think we missed the real problem, and we accuse them of things that are not true, and we like put labels on them as criminals, but in reality they're just people who come here to search for better, people in poverty, mm-hmm. and people that we should be helping. So I think we should step back and look at the real problem, because I think we miss it and we don't recognize it.
Were you able to listen to the speeches last night at the Republican National Convention, and what were your thoughts?
So I wasn't able to listen to a lot because we went to the rally and we came kind of late. But I did listen to a few commentaries, and just some saying that, well, there was a lot of stories about immigrants killing others and calling them criminals. I just think that because let's be honest, most of the people that were there at the event, they're part of that, you know, the top supremacy with money. So I just don't think they actually see the real problem. They actually see the poverty that's in America and that's happening. So they just see it from the other side, you know. They don't see both sides, and that's what's sad about it. Because if they actually stepped back and they took a look at both sides of the country that we are in, then they'll see that that's not the real problem, that we shouldn't be accusing them. Instead, we should find a way to help solve this poverty, find a way to give them opportunities so things like that don't happen.
You're part of Connecticut Students for a Dream, which advocates again for students who came here as young children. And under President Obama, you were able to have a sort of status in terms of having a work permit and not to worry about being deported. I mean, what are your fears with a new president in the White House?
My fear is that DACA will be taken away. As we know, it's an executive action. So that's my major fear. And that's not like my only fear, because I don't just worry about myself. I worry about my community. I worry about my people of color. We're already being oppressed. So imagine all that hatred coming from Trump against our people already, and it's just like his campaign. Imagine when he comes into presidency. Just imagine how that would be. You know, it's horrible. So I do worry about myself, but at most I worry about my people, my community, because I think that's what Trump is missing. I think he's just worrying about the top percent, and he's not really looking back and worrying about our people, the people of color, the people in the community.
We just have under a minute, Yanomar. Again, you're talking about traveling to Cleveland to protest outside the Republican National Convention against some of Donald Trump's policy and rhetoric. What are your plans later in this week in Cleveland?
Yeah, so our plan here, we had two goals. We wanted to show how the Trump presidency would be, how it would look, how it would be filled with fake hatred, and we did. We did that. We united with several other communities, and we showed that, and we're still going to show it throughout the week. We had a banner drop this morning, and it read, the GOP plus Donald Trump kills. It read signs like that. It was just very successful, and we're having an immigrant community. On Thursday?
Okay, Yanomar. We're actually running out of time, but I want to thank you. Yanomar Cortez joining us from Cleveland, where the group Connecticut Students for a Dream is protesting outside the RNC. This is Where We Live.